Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, EFF leader Julius Malema sentenced to a five-year prison term in his firearms discharge case. The International Monetary Fund warning that the Iran conflict could tip the world closer to recession. South Africa's visa shakeup could change the labor market game. And as fuel pain rises, more households are borrowing to survive. Is the short-term loan industry taking advantage? It's Thursday, the 16th of April. And let's lead the program with this. 5 years behind bars for Julius Malema, the leader of the EFF in his firearms discharge case. And suddenly the shifts from a legal story into a constitutional and political one. So what does the sentence mean in real terms? How quickly could it bite? And could it ultimately force him out of parliament? Let's get some instant legal analysis. Joining me is lawyer Ulrich Rue. Ulrich, good to talk to you. Thank you. 5 years. How significant is that sentence in legal terms, in your opinion?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thank you for having me. Yes, certainly a very significant sentence. I think if one looks at what the state said during aggravation of sentence, they pushed for a period of imprisonment of 15 years, given the reckless and negligent handling of the firearm charge, whereas the defense called for a suspended sentence coupled with a fine. And I think that the sentence handed down is a balanced sentence. I think it is a good sentence in the circumstances. But this is obviously just the first step now. Julius Malema is already lodging an application for leave to appeal, and we now await judgment on that application, which will be handed down today. And then one would have to wait and see whether he's granted leave to appeal, which will, of course, delay the serving of the sentence pending an outcome on that appeal.
Well, Ulrich, let's talk about that appeal. His legal representative, advocate Lawrence Hodes, is arguing, saying that there was no DNA evidence linking Malema to the crime, that the spent cartridge could not be linked to Malema, also raising concerns about a lack of eyewitness testimony. Give me a sense of how strong, then, the case is on appeal.
Well, you know, the state countered that argument by stating that there was clear video footage confirming that he did, in fact, handle the firearm, and that the court made the correct finding in accepting that video footage, that it was an accurate reflection of what actually transpired, and that, you know, it had not been tampered with. Coupled with that, remember that Julius Malema's version was that it was a toy gun that he was handling. So, you know, effectively, he admitted to having handled the firearm, claiming that it was a toy gun. That defense was and version was rejected by the magistrate, given that the state had led evidence by ballistic experts that it was clear that live ammunition was fired from that firearm. So his version was rejected, and I don't think that the argument pertaining to the lack of DNA will hold much water, to be honest.
Ulrich, given that Julius Malema has no previous convictions, 5 years is a fairly tough sentence, as you've suggested. What message do you think the state is trying to set out, or what message is the bench trying to send out?
Yes, well, you know, the offence that he was convicted of does fall under the Minimum Sentences Act, which means that a mandatory sentence of 15 years imprisonment is applicable. But if the accused person can prove exceptional circumstances which forces the court to deviate from that minimum sentence, then the court can hand down a lesser sentence, which is obviously what has transpired here. When sentencing a person, the court must take into consideration the personal circumstances of the accused person, the severity of the offence, and then, as you correctly point out, the message that is sent out to society by the sentence. Now, in this instance, Julius Malema does not have any previous convictions. But the severity of the offence, of course, we are all aware of the prevalence of crimes committed in South Africa by the reckless and negligent handling of a firearm. And certainly, I think that the sentence of 5 years imprisonment would serve as a deterring factor for would-be offenders in future. The South African Police Services and the NPA are attempting to really clamp down on crimes being committed through the use of firearms. And I think that this is definitely a clear message that has been sent out by the court, that it will no longer be tolerated whatsoever, and that harsh sentences will be handed down to people who recklessly handle firearms. Julius Malema, sorry, yes.
No, I was going to say, unquestionably, there is a political dynamic to all of this as well. So let's assume, and I understand that we're in the realm of speculation here, if the conviction stands, is removal from Parliament automatic or contested? Have you applied your mind to that?
Yes. In fact, the rules of Parliament and the Constitution in Section 47 actually states clearly that if a member of parliament receives a sentence of 1 year imprisonment or more, he is automatically disqualified from being a member of parliament. However, the caveat to that is that that would be only after the entire appeal process has been exhausted. So should Julius Malema now be successful in his application for leave to appeal, and should his appeal be pending, he will still be allowed to be a member of Parliament. If, however, the High Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal, or if he approaches the Constitutional Court, upholds the sentence, so in other words, the sentence of 5 years direct imprisonment stands, then Julius Malema will automatically be disqualified from being a member of Parliament.
There's no doubt, just to riff on your words, that this will be an exhausting appeal process. Is there any chance that this might even end up in the Constitutional Court on broader constitutional grounds, do you think?
Well, Julius Malema has indicated that he will approach the highest court in the country should it be necessary. So I don't think we should be surprised if at the end of the day it does end up in the Constitutional Court. But a lot of processes need to be followed before then. He must first now bring an application for leave to appeal, which he has. There must be judgment handed down on that. If he's granted leave to appeal, he will automatically be allowed to approach the High Court. If he's denied leave to appeal, then he will have to petition the High Court to appeal. And then, of course, if he's not successful in the High Court, one can expect him to approach the Supreme Court of Appeal. So certainly I would say at least another 2 to 3 years before there is clarity on whether this sentencing is going to stand or not.
Attorney Ulrich Roux, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is warning that if the conflict involving Iran escalates any further, and there's every likelihood that it will, the global economy could move a lot closer to recession. The concern, I would contend, is not just about the war itself, but what it does to oil prices, to inflation, investor confidence, and already fragile growth, not only globally, but here in South Africa. If energy markets tighten further and shipping routes come under more pressure, the shock could spread quickly through financial markets and into the so-called real economy. So how serious is this risk? And again, what could it mean for South Africa? In that respect, I am going to talk to a well-known and respected economist, Kanti Pai. Kanti, a very warm welcome to you. You've obviously seen the notes coming out of the IMF. How real do you think recession risk is right now?
No, it's quite real, Jeremy. As you know, we are coming off quite a vulnerable space, hardly recovered from the COVID-19. Obviously, the shock that also was introduced to the world last year, resulting from the US tariffs situation and the trade impacts of that. So as we're coming off that and we're coming into a new crisis, obviously that has particularly key important issues around logistics and certainly energy. As I say, facing those kinds of vulnerabilities, we can't say anything but that we are actually facing a serious downward trend.
Am I correct in saying that it's still mainly an oil shock? The Strait of Hormuz, for instance, still the biggest economic pressure point right now? Or do you think that it's something broader that is starting to play into the equation?
It's much broader now because it also has global risk and global volatility. volatility that has a strong impact on investment and investment flows, and certainly obviously then investor confidence. And then that also, as you know, will have impacts on inflation, and inflation obviously is a major driver of interest rates, which obviously constrain growth and investment themselves. So it has now become a much more widespread kind of risk rather than just a single impact.
When you talk about serious inflation fears, then where do you think we're heading globally?
Yeah, the IMF has certainly really actually steepened their forecast for inflation globally, and especially for emerging markets, especially those that are vulnerable, that don't have their own sources of fuel, fossil fuels, and have not actually transitioned or transformed properly. So that shock globally is going to be quite severe in terms of inflation.
This obviously derails any early hope for lower interest rates at this point. We could be looking at 6 months, maybe even a year before things start to soften again. Also, with the caveat that we simply don't know what the outcome is going to look like. It's just volatile and very opaque.
That's exactly the problem that we started out the way we saw it. You'd remember airlines, for example, were talking about surcharges, and everybody was assuming that we are just experiencing a short-term, immediate kind of shock. It looks like that it could be much more sustained, and that makes it difficult then to just look through, as many reserve banks, central banks would have, to say, look, let's just look through this because it's temporary. It's now starting to look like it's something that could be much more sustained.
So at this point then, Kanti, are we at the stage where market concern, even market panic to an extent, is becoming economic damage, or are we not quite there yet?
We are certainly moving quite closely to that. I think a lot of people are looking close to that, but it is coming to that because, again, the unpredictability is becoming ingrown. Remember, when we think about risk, you know, we think about something that could happen. And once the risk has materialized, then something is with us now. And the risk that we were facing, especially on a wider war, many of us have talked about this in the Middle East, is now materialized and is becoming something that becomes much more entrenched. And that becomes the problem. We would have seen it even in the previous year. So one of the key things when that disruption of trade as one of the key things, right? Because geopolitical risk introduced a serious risk on investment. And that is something that takes time to actually withdraw from markets.
Where does this leave central banks the world over right now? To what extent do you think they're being boxed in?
They're being boxed in a very serious way, especially because part of this was that they were starting to be concerned about, you know, everybody was starting to sort of celebrate, I guess, this sort of disinflation, or at least they were worried about, you know, this inflation that was coming down. And so everybody was sort of thinking, you know, we are at a very comfortable pace. We don't have too much to be worried about. Now they are finding that they might have to do something in the context of to look at interest rates and having to contend with inflation under circumstances of what we are thinking about as a depression that's also being warned at. That is something that's usually very, very difficult to deal with, because as you're trying to contend and you have that single instrument, which is interest rates, and at the same time you are facing downward trend in economic growth, or at the very least, at worst, a recession, it really constrains you.
Why do emerging markets seem to get hit harder in moments like this?
Well, much of it is because we are so dependent on exports. Our markets depend on global growth rather than any of the domestic sources, such as, you know, your own ability to consume, your own ability to invest. We actually are vulnerable to investment coming from outside rather than our own sources. So our vulnerabilities are really about what happens to everybody else. And as soon as everybody else withdraws, it affects us almost double, because we have very little resources for even ourselves. So, for example, in South Africa, if we think about one impact, that could be how farmers are affected through and inflation comes through fertilizer. We need to support farmers who may be, you know, so that food production is not affected and we don't see that inflation. But we don't have those resources as many emerging markets, because we're so constrained. We still have not recovered in our own ability to provide resources for infrastructure, for energy, for restructuring those economies. So we are still very much dependent on everybody else. And when everybody else is under that kinds of constraints, they doubly affect.
So against that backdrop then, what are you watching most closely here at home? Is it petrol, inflation, or the rand?
Petrol in particular, because that's a key transition, at least in, and then of course, as I said, the prices on the food prices that come through, the instability in the flow of fertilizer. So that is going to affect food prices in particular, you know, petrol and food. Those are the key headline issues that we watch that have been coming down quite nicely. And that's where now we are finding the most risk.
Thank you very much indeed for that very blunt and stark assessment, and obviously something that is, as you suggested, a plenty pie changing hour by hour. Nonetheless, appreciate your time and thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa, I read, is once again rewriting its immigration rules, with Cabinet now approving an updated white paper that, as I understand it, could bring some change to visas, to skills mobility, and perhaps importantly, how the country attracts foreign talent. Government says it's about tightening systems and aligning with economic priorities. Businesses long argue that a slow, unpredictable visa regime is costing the country investment and growth. Marissa Jacobs is with me, Managing Director at Expat Web and also Business Unity South Africa representative on the Immigration Advisory Board. And I want to discuss whether these latest reforms are going to fix the system or is this just another layer of complexity. So Marissa, to the point I've just made and welcome to you, we've seen multiple reforms over the years. Why should business believe this one is any different?
I think business always wants to be positive and wants to believe that the changes can really bring forward some change and allow business to attract the skills. The way in which the paper has been drafted certainly instills in us the belief that this will be different and that this is a move in the right direction, with a couple of the changes in here really showing once implemented, I think we'll really see some difference.
Marissa, what key changes then are noteworthy in this respect?
So I think from an employer perspective, the first one is the merging of two visa categories, the critical skills work visa and the general work visa, into one category called the skilled worker visa. This simplifies the visa process. It will fall under the points-based system, which means it's a more predictable system through which employers can attract talent. And so I think that's the big change from a business perspective that impacts directly on work visas. And then the other one, of course, is digitization. We've been talking for long about digitization. The white paper now brings into law the digitization of the Department of Home Affairs and also gives us a glimpse into what the plans are from a Department of Home Affairs perspective in terms of this big picture digitization for the department.
Do you think this is fundamentally about enabling growth or simply tightening control over immigration as it exists?
I think it's a bit of both. It's definitely a bit of both. There's a big talk around using immigration to grow the economy, which I think is vital. And for long, we've not really seen the Department of Home Affairs playing an active role in terms of being an economic enabler and how foreign direct investment and attracting skills, which the Department of Home Affairs is so important for, and what important role they play. So definitely on that side. But also, of course, I mean, the department is very much at the forefront of securing our borders and securing our citizenship data. So definitely a bit of both.
Is it too early to say that this is now going to make it easier for skilled professionals to choose South Africa? Is the jury still out, do you think?
I agree with you. I think it's too early to say, but I think we're moving in the right direction. We're definitely moving in the right direction. An example of that is the work visa rights for the spouses of work visa holders. I think that is for long we've not seen any budging from the Department of Home Affairs side in terms of this suggestion. They haven't quite rolled it out as automatic work authorization, which is what we were lobbying for, but they have said that there will be a relaxed regime for the spouses of foreigners coming in. So that's one of the examples, but definitely I do believe so.
All predicated, of course, Marissa, on whether the Department of Home Affairs is equipped to implement these changes. The last thing you want to see is another bottleneck.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that probably is the biggest nervousness from our side is great suggestions, but we know it's no secret that the department struggles with resources and implementing this, of course, is very much dependent on having those resources. Of course, the digitization is one of the ways within which the minister is trying to use the limited resources to actually tackle the big volume of applications that come in. But again, moving resources from human to digital is still resources that is needed. So that's definitely the big question mark.
And if you look at this white paper, how do you think we compare globally? Do you think we are starting to become a little more competitive, or at this stage, are we still falling behind peer economies?
This is definitely the biggest move that we've seen in the right direction, other than, of course, the Trusted Employer Scheme that was introduced 2 years ago. But this is definitely from a putting us on the global stage. This is a massive move in the right direction, and we're definitely starting to see how we as South Africa can compare to those big global markets, and especially when it comes to attracting investment and skills.
So Cabinet has approved an updated white paper. What's the timeline here?
There is no official timeline, but what I can say is the move from the draft paper to the approved paper by Parliament has been quite a quick move, from December last year to getting in the draft comments through to the final that's been 3-4 months. So that's quite a quick move in terms of white papers. So I am cautiously optimistic that the next phase will move with equal speed.
Maritza Jacobs, thank you very much indeed. Managing Director at Expat Web, and as I mentioned, also Business Unity South Africa representative on the Immigration Advisory Board.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as fuel prices climb, not only in South Africa, but around the world, and households come under even more pressure, the temptation, I think, to borrow just to stay afloat is growing. It makes sense. It's perfectly understandable. But in a high-cost economy, the real question is whether loans are still a useful financial tool, or whether more and more South Africans are slipping into short-term debt just to cover everyday life. It's a very real issue that is confronting lots of people. Let's talk now to Gavin Letley, who's product head at the personal loans company Direct Access. Gavin, a very warm welcome to you. Just from your assessment maybe over the past couple of weeks, how tough are things out there?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. I think things are getting tough at the moment. I think there was a lot of optimism post the budget speech, but then the recent crisis in the Middle East is going to put pressure on consumers going forward. I think the biggest worry going forward is the price of oil and fuel going up, which has a massive knock-on effect in terms of cost-push inflation, which plays into every person's life in South Africa. So I think things are getting a little bit bit more worrying at the moment going forward.
You describe loans, or the company describes loans, as a lifeline. But Gavin, if someone needs credit just to get through the month, and there's evidence that that is happening, is that not already proving that there is financial failure rather than financial health?
Yeah, so people are using credit more and more to get through. We did a recent survey saying that 28% of South Africans are using credit to cover emergency and to get by. But we always promise that credit should be used for good purposes, like, for example, home improvement, education. But I think that is swinging more, where people are trying to use credit to get through, but they must use credit in a sustainable mechanism. Make sure you can repay the credit, you understand the credit, and that you can don't overcommit yourself.
And that's fundamentally the problem with the credit model in South Africa, is so few people actually understand it and the real world implications, right?
Correct. So that's why we always promote credit education and credit well-being. So we always say to customers, understand your credit profile. And how that starts is understand what is your credit score. You can go to any of the credit bureaus, download a credit report, and fully understand your credit profile. Also, understand you can download free reports, like Direct Access offers a free credit score called Pulse, where it gives simple terms to understanding your credit profile and your credit circumstances, which impact you currently. And then we also say to customers, don't overcommit yourself. Before you take out any credit, fully understand what you're getting into and set and create a budget. A budget makes sure that you can commit to your financial commitments going forward and don't overextend yourself.
But so often, Gavin, the whole dynamic is driven by desperation, and your industry sells speed and convenience. But let me suggest to you that quick approval is precisely what makes it easier for stressed consumers to make bad long-term decisions in the short-term panic that is existing right now.
Yes, it does. But Most credit providers don't want customers to go bad. They want to make sure customers can afford the credit. So we always say to customers, before they take out the credit, fully understand your circumstances, understand what you're using the credit for, and understand the cost of that credit going forward. So make sure you fully understand the interest rate, the term, the initiation fees, the credit life linked to it, and how that builds into your budget before you take off. And yes, customers do need credit to get by, but sometimes that credit can be used for good in emergency situations. I'll use the example of recently I spoke to a customer. They live down in the Western Cape, and the storm's coming, winter's coming, and they urgently needed to fix their gutters before the rainy season came. So they've taken on a loan, fixed their gutters, with peace of mind that the house won't incur further damages over the winter rainy season in the Cape, which potentially would cost them more in the long run had they not fixed their gutters.
And that's one good example, but also difficult, I imagine, for the industry to justify lending to people whose budgets are already crushed by administered prices and transport costs. And often one repayment, I guess, can push them from coping into real default.
Yes, so if customers are under pressure, we always say to customers, reach out to your credit provider and speak to your credit provider if you're under pressure. There are mechanisms that all credit providers can give to help customers when they're going through times of strain. So, for example, speak to your credit provider. Maybe they can reduce your installments, extend your term. Also, there are other mechanisms offered by the National Credit Act, like debt counseling, which can help customers going forward to make sure that they can meet the financial obligations.
And Gavin, you'll agree that unsecured lending does carry some of the highest costs for consumers. Is it responsible finance and not maybe just expensive debt that is wrapped up in reassuring language?
So yes, unsecured credit is more expensive. So traditionally secured credit, you've got an asset tied to the credit. So the credit provider has recourse to that asset should you default. Unsecured credit is priced higher, as there's no asset linked to it. But credit providers also price based on your credit profile you have. So that's why I say it's very important to understand what your credit profile is and what your credit score is. If you improve your credit score over time, it actually allows you to get access to better interest rates, even in an unsecured environment going forward.
At what point do lenders accept moral responsibility in a situation like this, and given the parlous situation that so many people find themselves in, and not just legal compliance?
So, as I said earlier, we ask all customers to reach out to us if they're feeling, if they're in strain or financial pressure. Speak to your credit provider. Your credit provider does have a moral obligation to help customers, and it's not in the credit provider's best interest for the customer to default or to go to miss installments. They actually want to make sure customers can get through the cycle and always have access to credit.
Do you think things in the next couple of months are going to get worse?
I think a lot depends on the global situation. Like I said earlier, I think South Africa was in a very good situation economically a couple of months ago, and the global turmoil has put a lot of pressure and has decreased consumer and business sentiment. But I think as South Africans, we're always upbeat about the future of the economy, and we always pull through.
Well, let's hope that optimism comes to pass. Gavin Letley, I do appreciate your time today, product head at the personal loans company Direct Access. And on that note, that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.